The monks Barsanuphius and John lived in Gaza in a monastery, and both were hermits and very familiar with one another. Barsanuphius was a great spiritual director. He was referred to by his contemporaries as the great elder, or the great senior, or the great old man. Both he and John died sometime in the middle of the 6th century, Barsanuphius around 540 perhaps, and John around 530. Barsanuphius lived the life of a recluse. He lived in or either came to be surrounded by a monastic community, which was more or less surrounded his hermitage. There was an abbot of the local community named Seredos, and people would come to consult Barsanuphius, sometimes members of the community, often people from far away, and ask him questions. But Barsanuphius lived in complete isolation in his cell and never saw anyone. So when people would ask questions, he would write down the answers, or he would invite the abbot Seredos to write the answers, and that means that we have a collection of more than 600 written answers to spiritual questions or requests for advice, which Barsanuphius and his disciple and friend John provided. John was an individual who came to share Barsanuphius' cell. He is often referred to as the other elder, or the other senior, the other old man. Barsanuphius himself called John the prophet, and they lived together in the same cell for about 18 years. And after John's death, Barsanuphius withdrew into even greater solitude, and the date of his death is not known for certain. There were rumors and legends that he still existed that persisted into the 600s, into the following century, that he had not yet died. These are certainly certainly legends. But in any case, these two individuals provide us with an example of spiritual advice, of the tradition of spiritual elders offering counsel that is roughly contemporaneous with Saint Benedict, and gives us an understanding of what was happening in Palestinian monasticism at roughly the same time that Benedict of Nursia was beginning his monastic career. I've given you selections from some of the letters, and they give us a sense of how compassionate and gentle the advice that was offered by these two elders, particularly Barsanuphius, tended to be. The first series, letters 73 through up to the 80s, concern an older man, a member of a local community, who lived in the community that surrounded Barsanuphius and John, and who seems to have been very troublesome. He was revered as a spiritual elder, but he was quite sick and seemed to have had what we would today call scruples, interior concerns that would send him scurrying back to these spiritual elders with new questions about his sickness, about his fasting. He was particularly concerned about whether God would permit him to mitigate his fasting and his asceticism. And the answer of Barsanuphius is very positive, is of course that he is perfectly able to do this. And let's just take a couple of examples that we find in the letters. In letter 73, we find a rather beautiful statement. If you drop down several paragraphs, you'll find just the paragraph before the end of this letter. Barsanuphius says, "I bear half your burden now, and in the future God will be able again to help you." So Barsanuphius is very kindly and spiritually saying, you know, whatever fears you have, whatever concerns you have, let me spiritually carry them with you. I will bear these burdens for you, and I will bear half your burden. A very kind and compassionate thing to say. Well, letter 74, the same fellow, Andrew, comes back again saying, "Well, you said you were going to bear half my burden, but this is making me sad because I want all my sins to be forgiven. Now, can't you bear all of my burden?" Which again gives us an impression of the kind of difficult people with whom these elders had to deal. But notice the gentleness of the response of Barsanuphius. "I wonder at your love, brother, how you did not consider the facts of the love that is in accordance with God." And he goes on and says, "Well, if I'm able to bear the whole of your burden spiritually, I will certainly do that." We also find in this very interesting exchange of letters, not just a response to misunderstanding, but if you drop down to number 75, and I won't look this this in detail, but I'd invite you to come back to it if you wish. He's invited, Andrew is invited by Barsanuphius to find meaning in his suffering, not only to look for mitigations of the rules of fasting and of other forms of asceticism, but to seek the meaning of God in his experience of suffering. God will enable his suffering to have value and to have purpose. Then if we drop down to number 78, we find here an example, which again has to do with Andrew's concern that he's prevented from fasting, and he's worried again that God is not going to allow this. Here again, if you drop down several paragraphs, you'll find Barsanuphius saying at the beginning of this paragraph, condescend to your body a little, and it is no sin. In other words, allow yourself the indulgence that you have in order for you to deal responsibly with your body in this circumstance of illness. And then, really quite beautifully and uncharacteristically, Barsanuphius then invites this poor, relatively depressed and scrupulous man to meditate in a very beautiful way on heaven. Put off the old man with lusts and put on the new after which God has created, and rejoice, exulting in the Lord, making merry with his saints. Who can imagine or search out the ineffable joy of the saints, the inexpressible gladness, the unimaginable light? How, as they are here, he reveals to them his wonderful, glorious mysteries, the glory and refreshment that awaits them, alters their mind from the world, and always they, the saints, are seeing themselves in heaven with Christ and the angels. Hunger doesn't afflict them, thirst doesn't afflict them. He's inviting this poor troubled man to meditate on heaven. This is intriguing, of course, because one of the easiest and one might say cheapest ways of inducing penitence is to invite the person to meditate instead on hell and on suffering and on the consequences of sin. But here Barsanuphius, a very wise spiritual advisor, is inviting this poor Andrew to meditate instead on heaven, to consider the glories of heaven and the joys of living with the angels. Then, if we drop down to number 79, we have an example. Poor Andrew continues to whine even about his rheumatism, about his joint pain, and what one finds is just again a very gentle form of asceticism, and an encouragement to this person who's having very strange dreams. I see in dreams wild beasts, he says at the introduction of number 79. Barsanuphius' approach is, don't pay much attention to dreams. If you look down at the last paragraph of Barsanuphius' answer, as for the dreams of wild beasts, they are images conjured up by demons desiring to lead you astray, to believe your suffering is from them. But the Lord brings them to nothing by the words of his mouth. So Barsanuphius does not invite this man to meditate on dark, painful kinds of things, or worry that his pain comes from demonic sources, strictly speaking. No, these are images that are sent to try and to test you, but it's not a kind of punishment. And again, if you drop down to the next one, it's not just a question of his abstention from the ordinary forms of fasting, but here also this brother's complaining that he doesn't have time to sing the psalms. So, what about the fact that he's not really living monastic life, he's not living the asceticism of fasting, he's not engaging in other forms of asceticism, and he's not even praying the psalms. I don't have the strength for it. And John says, the scriptures have not forbidden, my brother, condescension to the body, made by way of indulgence with discrimination, with diakrisis. You have here an example of this beautiful virtue of discretion. You are permitted to mitigate your approach as long as it is appropriate given what is going on with your body. And in regard to psalmody, he says, don't be distressed. Because God does not require it of you during your sickness. If you're so sick that you can't pray the Psalms, don't worry. God doesn't expect that of you. If we drop down then to number 84, we find that we are in a different context. This is a different monk, not this poor, sick and rather repetitive Andrew bringing all of these complaints to Barsanuphius, but someone else who is concerned at one point about a demonic affliction, and Barsanuphius offers a Again, words of consolation and very simple spiritual advice. He then, in number 86, mentions the need again for balance, and particularly balance, and I'm sorry, that's beginning in number 85. Towards the end, where you have numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4 that I've added, he says again that in regard to psalmody and repeating by heart, commit yourself to do what God empowers you to do. Sing the psalms a little, repeat by heart a little, search within your own thoughts a bit, and give a little time for food. A very balanced notion of what this ascetical discipline is supposed to consist in. And then a rather beautiful thing that we find, his idea that, as he puts it, the whole day becomes your canonical prayer. It's not just a question of following a particular rule or a particular set of prayers, but rather allowing the whole day to be your prayer and your self-offering to God. He also talks about the searching of one's thoughts in number 86. He talks about the need to, in a very real sense, allow one's interior thoughts or temptations to be transformed into their opposite, into something that comes from God. If you look at the last paragraph of the answer to number 86, in regard to captivity, much vigilance is needed. If it takes your mind to fornication, you bring it to hallowing, to something making it holy. If you're thrust down to lustful thoughts, then you allow yourself to be to have that thought transformed into something that is life-giving, that is consecrating. If it's to gluttony, you bring it, you remind yourself of the need for asceticism. If your temptation is towards hatred, allow yourself to transform that thought into love. So it's not just a rejection of temptation, but a deliberate transformation of these temptations into the opposite, so that they then become experiences of the divine. And then in number 87, he gives an answer to a question in regard to unceasing prayer. And for him, again, it's a question of the individual, as he says, if you're reading and see compunction in your heart, read as much as you can. And when you're reciting the Psalms and find yourself filled with compunction, then use that recitation. He's inviting the individual to be sensitive to what's going on inside them spiritually, and then to give that the emphasis, rather than a predetermined kind of model of exactly what kinds of prayers need to be offered. In number 125, we won't look at this in detail, someone doesn't believe that Barsanuphius exists. He thinks that Abaceridos is bringing the answers back, and that there's no old man back there. And so, with this challenge, for the very first time, the only time, Barsanuphius appears. He basically comes out and washes the feet of the ones who are doubting his existence. So his solitude is capable of being interrupted for a very good reason. And finally, there is a very beautiful letter, number 143, that gives us a beautiful example of what, if you will, the canonical or practical or ordinary practice of prayer and psalmody consisted in for these Palestinian monks of the 6th century, and particularly for these hermits. And he recommends that one does have what he calls the fixed canonical hours. If you drop down to the section marked the answer of John, he reminds them that the monks of Egypt didn't have fixed canonical hours. Instead, he said, they perform manual labor, they meditated, or you might say recited, they repeated the scriptures to themselves, and they prayed at brief intervals. So he recommends that after a period of meditation or reflection, of repeating the scriptures to yourself, particularly the Psalms, you stand in prayer, ask to be freed from the old man, a phrase we've already seen, or pray the Our Father, or do both together, and then you sit down to manual labor again. So he gives a formula for how to pray at manual labor. Then he talks about extending the prayer, and talks about the possibility of ending each psalm with a very brief prayer taken from the Psalms. O God, have mercy on me, the wretched one. Kind of a very remote, very early anticipation of the much later Eastern tradition of the Jesus Prayer. He says, when you're assailed by thoughts, add, O God, you see my affliction, come to my aid. A reminder of that phrase that we find recommended particularly by John Cashin. And then he says, and if you want a kind of a way of keeping time for this, well, every time you've made three rows of the mat you're working on, stand for prayer, prostrate, and then arise again to pray. So he gives a kind of a way of incorporating prayer with one's work, of standing to pray periodically during the experience of monastic prayer. And then in the final section, which I've labeled with a dark bar, the two monastic daily offices, he reminds his hearers that in Egypt, in Skeet, there were 12 psalms, and at the end of each they said an Alleluia doxology and offered a prayer. And at night, the same kind of approach, 12 psalms, and after each psalm, after the end of the psalms, they would sit down to do their manual labor. And he says, and then during that period of manual labor, you may memorize, that is to say, memorize the scriptures, or meditate on, be aware of your own tempting thoughts, or read, reflect on the lives of the fathers. And he gives a recommendation of how many pages should be read periodically, interspersed with one's work. And again, this is a very beautiful and rare example of the kind of actual spiritual practice, the kind of prayer discipline that was being lived out by one of these desert fathers during this early period of the Christian church. And again, the letters of Barsanuphius and John are finally becoming available in good English translations. They're available from the Catholic University of America Press in a first volume, and several volumes will be coming out in the future to presumably to cover the whole of the 600 letter corpus.